From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters.
All right, that's it. Go up and through. It's a beautiful park, actually. I've never really seen a picture of him that I believed was quite right. I could quite capture him. I think there was something kind of romantic about his whole look, you know, that he was, if not classically beautiful, then he was striking and very active, very strong, and certainly not someone who you can ignore.
That is Steve Schenken. He used to write history textbooks for kids, but he doesn't anymore. We went for a walk, and I asked him to tell me everything he knows about Benedict Arnold.
Kind of average size, but very muscular. And he was always jumping over things and lifting things. And wonderful ice skater. It's said that his calf just looked fabulous in a stocking. Great legs, you know.
All I ever learned about Benedict Arnold is that he was the biggest traitor in American history. He was an American who switched sides and sold out to the British Army. He betrayed his country, our country. But Steve Schenken doesn't see it like that, or not exactly. He told me that back before the betrayal, Benedict Arnold was a decorated major general, and he won us a crucial victory in the Revolutionary War. It was the Battle of Saratoga, here in upstate New York, where we're walking up this hill. And it was here at this battle where Benedict Arnold was shot in the leg. And it was an injury he'd never fully recover from. This battlefield from the Revolutionary War is one of Steve Schenken's favorite places. And he wants to show me something up these hills that's hiding in plain sight.
What happened here, I think is important because he was still in the army, but he was wounded, so the wound in his leg was, even once it healed, he couldn't walk without a cane. He had to have a special shoe made, and so he couldn't ride a horse very well, certainly not well enough to lead men in battle. And this is when Washington makes arguably the worst decision.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
the way we've always been.
The podcast about
the unknown.
Yeah, the writing came about through just wanting to be a writer. I tried many other things, and I worked on low-budget movies and writing fiction and comics and all kinds of things. But I finally got a job in New York City writing for educational publishing companies, textbooks, essentially. And it actually was the greatest kind of blessing in disguise that ever happened to me. And a big moment in my life, in my writing life, came when the editors told me, okay, now basically this is your big break. You're going to write part of this new fifth grade U.S. history book. Not just any part, but you're going to write the American Revolution, because if you can't make that exciting for 10-year-olds, you're screwed, you know, because after that, you've got the Constitutional Convention and the War of 1812, and you're dead. So if you can't work with the Revolution, that's how they think. So, all right, so we'll give you the softball. You can write that. But we want, and they always say this, we want you to make it exciting. We don't want it to be the same old boring. Believe it or not, they know textbooks are boring, and we don't want it to be that. So come up with grabbers, and each chapter will start with this little scene. It'll be a scene, just like a movie. And so I said, okay, I took them quite literally. I really had this arrogant and quite innocent idea, really, that I was going to change the way these textbooks were, because why not? I was very naive.
Were you nervous about this new project?
I saw, yes, but I saw it more as an opportunity than anything, or really like a big break. It really felt like a big break. And so I went and did a lot of research and came up with many, what I thought, good grabbers. I'll tell you one of them and the reaction to it, because it's symbolic of everything. So here's one story, classic example. This is the early days of the revolution. And Paul Revere is famous, of course, for his ride. And he told the story from that night that is lesser known than the riding on the horse part. It comes before that. And it's just a great and very cinematic kind of opening scene where it's night in Boston and soldiers are marching on the cobblestone streets down to the water to go out on this mission to take the weapons away from colonists outside of town. And Revere knows it, and his mission is to get out there and warn them. But when he gets down to the river, there's a big British warship right there. He was meaning to row across the river, but now he realizes it's going to be kind of obvious. They're going to catch me. So he had some guys who were going to row him across, and they realized their one chance was to be silent in the water, which means they needed some cloth. If this ever comes up in your life, you need to get some cloth to wrap around the oar lock so that it can kind of muffle the sound of the clanking. So one of them said, oh, I know a woman who lives right around the corner. And they ran through the dark streets and called up to her window and said, we need a piece of cloth. And she, without missing a beat, ripped off the petticoat she was wearing and threw it out the window. And Revere caught it, later noting that it was still warm from her body. And they used it. They ran down to the river and ripped it up, wrapped it around the oars, made it across. Someone was waiting with a horse. And there begins the famous part of Paul Revere's night, riding out of town and telling everyone the British were coming. And that part makes the history books. But this earlier part is just a great little scene. I thought I could tell it in, say, 150 words. To me, that has all the elements of a grabber. It's a great little scene. And I, again, pitched it, and it really felt like kind of a pitch meeting. Again, I'm in this office room with two experienced editors, and I have a notebook, and I'm leaning forward in my chair as I describe this exciting scene. And they were nodding, and it sounded like it was going well. And then there was a long pause, and they started to look a little bit concerned, and they looked at each other, kind of communicating soundlessly with one another. And then one of them, well, it's really great, but let's see, we definitely can't say the cloth was warm from her body. And I said, okay, I mean, that's a good detail, but I could understand, sort of. And they said, yeah, and we shouldn't really have her taking off the petticoat, because that's kind of like taking off underwear. And I said, well, that's kind of essential to the story, but okay. And then, well, we really shouldn't have underwear at all in the story, because that could be very disruptive in a classroom. And some parent inevitably will be offended and will get in trouble. And this went on until all that was left was a textbook. All that was left was, you know, in April in 1775, and Paul Revere needed some cloth. A woman threw down a piece of clothing. They rode across the river. He got on a horse and began to ride. You know, and that's... So you wonder how textbooks are born. How do they end up with that language and that lack of anything that has any spark of life in it? And it's because of this, because they start with something that's fundamentally interesting and then strip out anything that could get them in trouble. They really worry about getting in trouble, editors.
What were you thinking, and how did you behave?
I was thinking to myself, they're ruining the story. But I wasn't totally discouraged at that point. And it took me quite a long time to become totally discouraged. Many, I would say years, because I just kept trying. And I just kept putting in other things. Oh, they don't like that story. I didn't really learn my lesson very quickly. And I just kept putting in other stories, like George Washington, who comes across as incredibly boring in textbooks, told the story when he was 16, he got this job as a surveyor, and in his journal described the first night of being a surveyor. And he didn't really know what he was doing, and he was with these tough guys camping out in the woods. And when he got into his little sleeping arrangement at night, they were outside, but some blankets that he had, he thought you were supposed to just take off all your clothes to go to sleep. So he did. He just got under his blankets and stripped off all his clothes, and then realized that the bed, such as it was filled with vermin and fleas and lice, and they start crawling all over his naked body. But he didn't want to get up because he was embarrassed to jump out of the bed naked in front of all these guys. So he waited. He just kind of suffered through the night until the fire died down, and then he jumped up and put on his clothes. Now, would that ever show up on a test or on a state standard somewhere? Of course not. But if I could tell you that story before I tell you the famous things that he did that we do want you to remember, isn't that more likely to make you keep reading and remember things about him? That was my theory. And of course, not of course, at the time, I didn't realize it, but that was totally inappropriate. They said, you can't tell that story because you can't have George Washington getting naked, because that's disrespectful to him.
Disrespectful?
Yeah.
Does that mean that it's disrespectful? Does that mean that that there's something also about creating a mythology around some of the founding fathers? So it's not just it's disrespectful, but it runs counter to our mythology about this person being... Is that... Do you find that that is true, too, that he has to be wise in all moments?
That's what I eventually figured out. There was something much more going on than just being people being offended. That this is our creation story for our country. And people really want to control how we tell it and how we think of ourselves. And what it really comes down to, and this took me a while to realize, was that there are two basic ways of seeing American history. And these pressures really pound on one another in many ways, but certainly in the textbook world and how we write history. And one is that we started out perfect as this city on a hill, chosen and blessed by God, with these wonderful founders, and we've been messing it up ever since. And then the other version of it is that we started off with beautiful ideals and beautiful documents, but falling very short of actually living those ideals. And that ever since, in the 200 plus years, we've been slowly, wrenchingly, very painfully expanding those beautiful ideals to more and more of our people. And those are really the two ways of looking at American history. And I think they're the two ways of looking at where we are today in our country. And I think it's very relevant even to the recent election and to Donald Trump when you think about Make America Great Again. He's talking about going back to a time when we were better. And I think that part of what he means by that is to recapture that glorious moment when we were that city on a hill and these wonderful founders who were blessed by God. And that there's something blasphemous from that perspective of pointing out the faults in our country and the terrible things that we've done.
In those two kind of theories of the founding of this country, where does the incredible violent nature of the beginning of this country, where does it fall, both American Indians and slaves?
I know.
Where do they live in those two theories?
They're in there. This really comes up in textbook writing because there are pressure groups, particularly in Texas, right-wing groups that are very influential, in which books get adopted or officially approved by states, especially Texas, which is such a huge market. And so we're very concerned about what they say because they could destroy a potentially, you know, millions of dollars worth of business for a company. So we, as the textbook makers, couldn't afford to offend them.
Why is Texas such a big market?
It's a very big state. They buy millions and millions of dollars worth of books. So you want them to be considering your book. If they don't adopt or officially approve your book, your company's book, then we can't sell it in that state. And you lose out on millions of dollars, and heads will roll in the office, of course, because they want to know who put that thing in that caused our book to get all this flack. And so I had to get to know these organizations well, and in fact even shared manuscript with them to get their opinions of it beforehand and let them comment on it beforehand. So they rationalize it all. They have it all figured out. Their opinion is that Slavery existed everywhere, but white Christians were the only ones to realize it was wrong. That was one of the notes I got. As far as the American Indians go, we were trying to help them by showing them a better way to live and a better religion. And many people got it. Many of them got it, but many didn't and decided to make war on the whites. And that's the cause of all that trouble.
So you would get notes that said these things?
Oh, yes. And in the context, again, of what comes out of Trump's world and his supporters, does that surprise you in any way? I mean,
it just seems in the world of education, it's a little bit notable that it would be stated as fact.
Right, as fact. Yeah, and again, this was a world where facts don't matter too much. You start with a theory, you start with what you want to believe, and then you mold, quote, facts to fit that theory. So maybe these guys were ahead of their time in what they were doing politically, but that is what they were doing, and they would absolutely, unabashedly, just say these founders of ours were perfect, and if you think they did something wrong, it's because you just don't get it.
So it was religious. There were religious overtones.
Number one is yes, the religion and free market are the two big ones, and by religion I mean Protestant Christianity was by far their number one mission in terms of shaping textbooks, to say that this was a Christian nation founded by people who believed this version of religion. Like, here's a really strange example, but again, a Washington story, desperate to make him come alive and not be so ye olde and stiff. When he was a young man, early 20s, he was in the French and Indian War. He sort of started the French and Indian War by accident, which I think is a good story that never gets out there. But he was this kind of bumbling young officer who stumbled into a firefight with he was on this, of course, the side of the British, so he's fighting the French in these days. And it was a disaster, and their horses were shot out from under him. He had bullet holes through his coat. And he wrote a letter to his mother about it, saying just that. He said, I luckily survived, though I had four horses shot from under me and holes through my coat. And so I used to quote a passage from that letter. And one of these Texas groups got a hold of it ahead of time and said, you can't say that George Washington was lucky, because it wasn't luck, it was the hand of God. And why are you censoring God? That might be the number one critique that I got in my notes, and they would come on these sticky notes. Why are you censoring God? And I tried to point out that this was a quote. I was quoting a letter from George Washington, and they said, yeah, but let's just cut it, because it's, why get into trouble over this? Just find something else. And inevitably, you find something less interesting. And again, that contributes to making textbooks the way they are. And so what we got really good at in the office was being preemptively offended by our own writing, so that we would say, all right, let's write something and then see if we're offended by it, and take the position from both right and left. And the comments that we would get from the PC crowd, the left-leaning crowd, were things like, all right, you describe Washington crossing the Delaware, and there's that famous, you know, that famous painting of that. And so I would get a note saying, oh, come on, that's just a bunch of white men in a boat. Do we really need to hear that story again? People get so caught up in it just being the mythology of the white men in a boat that, again, you throw up your hands and say, all right, I'll just say something else instead.
What's the danger of our own imperfection in our founding story?
I don't see a danger in it. I see it as hopeful, actually. Well, I guess someone could argue that we need those heroes. We need something to work toward. And that if we don't think there's anything special about us, then why bother? You know, what are we here for? What are we trying to accomplish? And
what are they afraid of? I guess that's the better question.
I think that's it. They're afraid of this kind of relativism that we're all good, you know, we're all basically the same, and there's good and bad in everyone. And I think that's what they're afraid of. And then we lose our exceptionalism and we're nothing special. And that we don't have a special mission in the world. And I think that's kind of where it comes from. We don't have a right to to be richer than everyone and use more resources than everyone. And we're just regular people. I don't even argue. I see a lot of merit in the exceptional argument, actually. I think this country is exceptional. I think if aliens were studying the last 200 years of this planet, they would say by far the rise of the United States was by far the most important difference maker in human history in that time, moving the ball forward for human freedom and opportunity in ways that had never even been tried before. So why can't we believe that and at the same time admit that we've made a lot of mistakes that we have to continue to try to undo? To me, that's what patriotism is. I don't really see that danger at all. I think it's very clear. We've done wonderful things in the world. I don't see that as being in contradiction with being honest about the terrible things we've done too and that we're still living with. And again, it all comes back to how you teach history. If you go to middle school or even younger and tell the kids that people who write history, official history, are worried that you won't be able to handle a moral contradiction, they become very angry. They get really, really upset by that. And they say, wait a minute. First of all, of course we can handle it. We see it in our lives with people we know. And also, that's what makes it interesting. And so there's a really huge disconnect in that way. The people who are making this official history just don't get how kids think at all and don't trust them. They don't trust kids to know that, yeah, there were good guys who were also bad guys, and that's okay. That's the way we've always been. That's the way we are now. Another one of the lessons that I learned in textbook writing was Benedict Arnold. I didn't really know anything about him other than that he was a traitor, but I started reading and saying, hey, these stories are pretty interesting. Turns out he's sort of like this loose cannon action hero, you know, something out of Hollywood, but way before Hollywood. And when I tried to put him in, he was always cut out immediately. And I pressed my editors because, again, I was very annoying in that way. And one of the editors said, you know, Benedict Arnold makes people nervous. I had to think about it really for a couple of years to get it. What he meant was, it was quite a good insight. Arnold was a bad guy. That's what we know about him. He's a bad guy. But he was also a good guy. He was also a hero. For many years, he was one of the great heroes of the revolution. And you could argue that we wouldn't have won when and how we did if not for his contributions, or we certainly could have lost the war without him. I believe that based on my understanding of history. And so that's what makes people nervous, because if he's a bad guy and a good guy, then what about the good guys who are also bad guys? And then you start thinking about Washington and Jefferson and Patrick Henry and the fact that our national anthem was written by a slave owner and everything. And then you start to get morally confused. And it goes back to, what are we worried about? I think that's what we're worried about, getting that moral. Are we good after all? Or is there something wrong with us? And so it opens up that door. Arnold opens up the door. And so, years later, when they wanted to turn Saratoga into a park, the battlefield park, they just didn't know what to do with Arnold. Do we make a statue to this guy? How can you make a statue to a traitor? But on the other hand, how do you ignore someone who was the heart of this turning point of the war? And they did something in between, which we've just stumbled upon here. They made a statue to his leg. They said, we don't really like Arnold, but we do like his leg, because that's cool. That was part that was shot for the Americans. And so we respect that and we honor that. But the rest of him could be just chopped off and hanged as far as we're concerned. And they
came up with this crazy idea for a monument, which is almost in jail. It's surrounded by this black fence. And it's just his boot. They call it the boot. But this represents his leg that was shot here, winning the Battle of Saratoga. It has a little dedication in memory of the, quote, most brilliant soldier, end quote, of the Continental Army, who was desperately wounded on this spot, the sally port of Burgoyne's Great Western Redoubt, 7th October, 1777, winning for his countrymen the decisive battle of the American Revolution and for himself the rank of Major General. That's just freaky. It's very weird and a creepy monument even. And you just have to know. You're just supposed to know that this is the Arnold Monument. And it's certainly the only Benedict Arnold statue you'll see in the United States. The heroes get these beautiful monuments. But Arnold, we have to do something kind of different with and just so a part of him, because we're just not comfortable telling the whole story.
Erica Heilman produced this episode of Here Be Monsters. Erica is the host of Rumble Strip, a podcast that I really think you should listen to. Erica interviews people in this way that reminds me of no one else, and I think her show is great. Erica originally produced this piece for Rumble Strip with a different title. She called it Benedict Arnold's Leg. You can find out more about her show and subscribe at rumblestripvermont.com. Steve Schenken is the author of many, many children's history books, including The Notorious Benedict Arnold, a true story of adventure, heroism, and treachery. We have a picture of Steve up on our website, where you can also go to see America's only statue for Benedict Arnold. You can find us online, or hbmpodcast.com. My name is Jeff Emptman. I produce and edit this show along with Bethany Denton. Our editor at KCRW is Nick White.
It said that his calf just looked fabulous in a stocking. Wonderful ice skater.
Music on this episode came from Swamp Dog and The Black Spot. Here Be Monsters is a part of the Independent Producer Project from KCRW. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.
They'll never get it right. They'll never understand that it doesn't matter what you say in a book. That doesn't matter at all. If what's in the book can't be lifted from that page and into a kid's head. Eventually I kind of shrugged about text and said, you can write it however you want, because I can write a book that a kid would actually read and have much bigger influence on them. And it's not gonna be political, it's gonna be funny. It's going to be gross and weird.